Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Carlisle Day. There is a whole schedule of presentations arranged for you. And to kick things off, I'm going to provide a book guide to help people navigate their way through Carlisle's works. Now, it just so happens that I've already made a book guide, and really, there wasn't anything new to add to it that I hadn't already said, beyond, I think, providing a more robust general introduction to Carlisle before we get into the individual work. So what we in effect have is my old book guide with a new introduction, just to help you ease into it, so to speak. So let us start. First thing I want to look at is the development of his social thought. I then want to give you Carlisle's basic thesis of what he called the condition of England question and how to solve that condition. Then I want to talk briefly about Carlisle's literary devices, his Germanism, his religious conviction, and his authoritarianism, and then we'll get into the book guide. So I think that his chief political and social thought are actually captured in just four books. Chartism, which he wrote in 1840, outlines the basic diagnosis of the problem. But in that work, he focuses more on the material conditions, and he speaks with an analytical or editorial voice. Then in On Heroes and On Hero Worship, he develops his idea of the sort of leadership necessary for a well-ordered and just society. And in that which is actually a lecture series, he speaks more with the voice of an historian. Then in Past and Present, he adds to the diagnosis of Chartism, but comes to see the condition of England question chiefly as a spiritual problem. And he proposes solutions and a positive vision for a future based on an idyllic past. That's the past point. And then Past and Present actually finishes with a kind of horoscope of the future. And in Past and Present, he assumes for the first time the voice of a prophet. He writes in that book as if his word is backed by the voice of God. And then in Latter Day Pamphlets, which was written a few years later, the diagnosis and the proposed solutions have not really changed a great deal from Past and Present, but his rhetoric becomes a lot more apocalyptic. He furiously laments his audience in the Latter Day Pamphlets, and he starts to believe that they are beyond saving and that the hope is lost. You know, in Past and Present, he talks about people who have lost their way, who still might be saved, whereas in Latter Day Pamphlets, it's much more, you know, they are blinded to the truth. And this makes the Latter Day Pamphlets a much more reactionary text, even though the substance of the ideas is substantially the same. So what was Carlyle's central thesis? Well, according to Carlyle, the chief causes of England's and Europe's problems are atheism, democracy, and laissez-faire economics. Atheism, he comes to see, especially in Past and Present, from then onwards, as the primary cause of which democracy and laissez-faire economics are major symptoms that compound the damage. I mean, democracy and laissez-faire economics cause further problems, but they in turn are caused by the chief problem, which is the loss of spiritual values in England. All of these, that is, atheism, democracy, and laissez-faire economics, are rebellions against the natural order of the world. They are the anarchy and disorder that result from a great failure to recognize the transcendent. Order needs to be restored by heroes, great men who come as prophets, writers, priests, and leaders who can bend history to their will. One problem with the universal quagmire in which we find ourselves is that conditions do not lend themselves for heroes to rise, and instead we are surrounded by quacks and sham captains. Carlyle is forever lamenting the fact that the quacks, you know, so-called experts, professors of the dismal science, are, you know, selling us lies. They're selling us kind of false remedies for the problem. And then the sham captains are, you know, people who assume the positions of leadership, but who are in fact fakes. You know, they're not really wise leaders. He also calls them phantasm captains on occasion as well. Now, during this next section, I'm going to intersperse what I've outlined here with some insights from the late Jonathan Bowden, who gave a great lecture on Carlyle called Thomas Carlyle, the Sage of Chelsea. And I think that some of the insights of Bowden are highly relevant, and they illustrate what I'm talking about quite well. So there's going to be a bit of academic agent featuring Bowden for the next few moments. Let us start with Carlyle's Germanism. He exalted Teutonic virtues and was responsible for bringing much German literature and thought to the English-speaking world. He venerated Martin Luther and Goethe as heroes. He wrote a biography of Schiller. He wrote influential articles on Novalis and Richter. Later in life, he became obsessed with Frederick the Great of Prussia, kind of huge work that consumed him in his later years.
He began a long exploration of the cultural channel in the West that was to open up for him his own sensibility, that in turn would ramify with his Scottish and Calvinist roots. And this was German literature and German philosophical and idealist literature from the early part to the middle part of the 19th century. It is not an exaggeration to say that he opened up the British and in turn the English mind to Germany and to Germanic culture in his era, to such a degree that his reputation suffered a great deal during the 20th century because of his Germanophile nature. He corresponded directly with Goethe. One of his slogans was, close your Byron and open your Goethe. He translated Wilhelm Meister, one of Goethe's novels. He translated four volumes of German literature that were published one after the other and that dealt with writers like Richter and with certain of the idealist schools such as Fichte and so on. In these writers, he saw a way to transliterate the spiritual yearnings that he felt in a way that could be communicated in a manner that could be understood and appreciated by his era. Born in some respects conceptually outside his era, like a seer and a prophet, he came in part to dominate it. It's a strange chronology whereby he begins as an absolute outsider and ends, loaded with honours, many of which he chose to reject individually, at the centre of his culture.
Now we have the issue of Carlyle's literary devices. Now, Carlyle has a really unique way of writing, as anyone who's even come close to reading any of his works will instantly recognize. He adopts different narrators in his works, and these each have distinct voices. Like I said, there's an obvious shift in tone between Chartism, which is much more kind of scholarly and neutral, by Carlyle standards, that is, when compared with past and present, where he adopts very much the voice of the prophet. He also frequently inserts a neutral observer character. In past and present, there's this newspaper reporter from the Houndsditch Indicator, or in the occasional discourse on the Negro question, there's Felin McQuirk, who's also a reporter, noting down this speech by an unknown orator. And I mean, in that, you know, he's giving a speech and this reporter is, you know, recounting what he said and then inserting little comments here and there. And we get to see what the how the crowd reacts. And all of these, this observer character distances Carlyle's own authorial voice, and it allows him to play on perception, especially when the narrator and the observer character interact or start disagreeing with each other. You see this a little bit. This is possibly something that he borrowed from Thomas More, who employs a similar device in Utopia. Anyway, he also employs framing devices. You know, like the one I just mentioned in the occasional discourse, often as a way of poking fun at the pomposity of polite and respectable liberal society. He often personifies the concepts that he criticizes as characters, such as Bobus Higgins, sausage maker on the great scale, Plugson of Undershot, two industrialists who represent much that Carlyle laments in his contemporary England. He also builds up his own vocabulary and in-jokes, which frequently recur. This has become known as Carlyleese or Carlyleisms. And later on today, I'll be doing an A to Z of such Carlyleese. He drops any pretense of the detached, value-free, scholarly voice. He often addresses the reader directly, sometimes in a chastising way, especially in the latter-day pamphlets. And he also uses the direct address and the rhetorical intensity of the style frequently tilt over. You know, sometimes it comes like an avalanche. You know, it's building up, and now, you know, pages and pages where he just starts like ranting. You almost hear the thunder or the fire, you know, burning up the page as he writes. When he does that, it becomes much more like listening to a sermon of a firebrand preacher. You know, he says things like, "Oh, brothers," you know, he's addressing the crowd. Here's Bowden on Carlyle's style.
His first great literary work is The Philosophy of Clothes, or Sartor Resartus, which is designed as an exemplification of idealist thought, an introduction of what might be otherwise an obscure or arcane area to English and British audiences, listeners and readers. Don't forget, the number of people who could read fluently then was much smaller than now, and the tradition of one person reading to a group, the oral nature of literature, is extraordinarily important to Carlyle. Carlyle's prose style has never really been approximated to by anyone else. There is an extraordinary torrent of allusion and inversion and the use of the dash and the use of epigrammatic insights and a torrent of phrase and a persuasion, nearly always related to a central philosophical idea that underpins the work or lies to one side of it. Carlyle was a religious thinker in a totally secularizing manner, in that he spoke to modernity. He spoke to an age of capital and of machines. He spoke to an age of science, but he used the mechanism of the pulpit and the jargon and language of Knox, which he transmuted in his own mind into a living and sinuous and prosodic form of narrative that he made all his own. Carlyleese, it was called at the time, and no one really has ever written in that way since.
Now I'd like to talk a little bit about Carlyle's religious convictions. He rejected Christianity, so he wasn't a conventional Christian by any means. In terms of the God made flesh, he exclaimed, "Did God Almighty come down and make wheelbarrows in a shop?" And for this reason, he was sometimes called an atheist by contemporaries. But this fails to recognize the profound spiritual dimension of his thinking. When he was called an atheist, that just meant he wasn't an orthodox Christian. He had kind of heterodox views and clearly didn't accept the figure of Jesus. He wrote to his wife Jane in 1846, "He is no Jew or man or image of a man or Jew or surplice or old creed. He is the unnameable maker of us, voiceless, formless within our soul, whose voice is every noble and genuine impulse of our souls." Now, despite this ostensible rejection of Christian creed, even though obviously he profoundly believed in God, there are many unmistakably Calvinist tones and notes in his thinking, including his belief in the sacred nature of work, not to mention his explicit worship of Cromwell, which led James Anthony Froude famously to describe his religious thought as Calvinist without the theology. And I think that Carlyle could be thought of as a kind of perennial traditionalist. His analysis of Europe's issues and of England's issues is essentially the same as that offered by René Guénon, especially the idea of the reign of quantity. This is something that Carlyle's always, Carlyle's always lamenting the bean counters and the utilitarian way of seeing the world and the dismal science of economics. And so there's a lot that chimes with Guénon, and of course Julius Evola, especially the focus on the transcendent and the loss of any spiritual dimension to belief being at the root of our issues today.
When he had what for him was a mystical experience whereby he saw the interconnectedness of all things. Carlyle believed in the reality of God in all areas and at all times, and he believed that all things are interconnected with each other. But in a way, of course, he is reaching way back into the Western and the Greco-Roman tradition. Heraclitus, in his lost book on nature 2,500 years ago, believed that energy was the basis of all life and of all being and of all becoming, and that that energy was in some respects flame. And the idea of the interconnectedness of all matter, and that which describes it, and that which psychologically alludes to it, and that which could be said by certain human values to be above it, was part of Carlyle's vision. This is why he could write about cultural heroes, he could write about Chartism, a movement of mass democratic and trade union-related reform in the 19th century, which convulsed the masses of that era and ultimately led in part to the democracy we now have in the British Isles. He could also write about the slave trade. His most controversial text in many ways, which is not reprinted in the Penguin Condensed Carlyle, which people are very dubious about in certain respects. Laws have been passed, which means that even the title of that work I can't mention in a meeting like this. But suffice it to say, John Stuart Mill, his old friend and rival later on, wrote a riposte to it called The Negro Question. And so you can sort of adumbrate from that what Carlyle was saying and indeed what the title of that work was.
Finally, and then we will get onto the book guide after seeing Bowden for one last time, I want to talk about Carlyle's authoritarianism. He advocated the use of force to bring order and thought nothing of subordinating the will of the individual to the collective. Carlyle was not a liberal thinker by any means. His heroes thus tended to be autocrats, such as Oliver Cromwell, Frederick the Great, and the Paraguayan dictator, Dr. Francia. Now this, as well as his popularity with German conservative revolutionaries, and we saw the influence of German idealists on him in turn, and his popularity with National Socialists, has caused Carlyle to be labelled retroactively as a proto-fascist. Although Naturally, scholars have debated back and forth as to how accurate these labels are. I think it is worth being aware of that up front before we get into him.
Carlyle believed that life was hierarchical, but that hierarchy had to be based upon the principle of justice. This is why he's uncomfortable reading for the mainstream conservative tradition and for all forms of liberalism and accredited reform.
By Foundations of Writing on the Academic Agency. To write clearly will help you to think clearly. The ability to communicate ideas in lucid prose is foundational to success in many areas, and it is a basic requirement in every walk of life. You will learn the parts of speech and come to understand the core functions of the English language, sentence construction and syntax, punctuation, style, and common mistakes. Once you see how mistakes are made, you will not unsee them. You will know for the rest of your life. Foundations of Writing. Buy it now.
Hello, everyone. A few people have asked me to make a buying guide to Thomas Carlyle's books after I pointed out on an earlier video that if you search Amazon for Thomas Carlyle, there are hundreds and hundreds of subpar copies from two-bit presses. And that puts people off from actually buying Carlyle's book. So this video is going to serve as a buying guide, but also as a kind of general introduction to Carlyle for people who are looking to get into him and start reading him. All of his books are actually available free of charge in the public domain. So if you are not interested in buying physical copies of books and just for reading, you can ignore my recommendations for reading and simply go to archive.org or simply search DuckDuckGo or any other search engine for these works, and you'll probably be able to find a PDF of them fairly easily, although a lot of people who are into reading do like the physical copies nonetheless. So there is Thomas Carlyle. You're looking at him there, the famously dour and idiosyncratic Scotsman. And he chiefly wrote history. Thomas Carlyle was a historian, but unlike any historian you have ever read in your life, he's very literary. He uses a lot of rhetorical tricks. He is insanely biased in his opinions when he's writing that history. He mixes things that you usually see in other genres in with his prose. And he also has essays and books of social commentary as well. And it is chiefly the social commentary that a lot of you will be wanting to read, but his histories are very good as well. So he wrote a lot of stuff in his career. You can see there is his 30 volume collected works, starting with the novel Sartor Resturus, which is volume 1. Then there's The French Revolution, 3-volume book, very famous history of the French Revolution, written by Carlyle. Then there is The Life of Friedrich Schiller. I haven't read that one, and I don't intend to. There is Critical and Miscellaneous Essays. That is an important collection of essays of his, 5 volumes. Heroes and Hero Worship, volume 12, Past and Present, volume 13, Oliver Cromwell, volumes 14 to 18. Now, that is actually a collection of Oliver Cromwell's articles and letters and speeches and things like that. I haven't read that either, and that would probably only be of interest to Cromwell scholars, I'd imagine. Then there's the Latter-day Pamphlets, a great reactionary book. The Life of John Sterling, which, again, I haven't read. And then his enormous 6-volume biography of Frederick the Great, which I haven't read either. But Mencius Moldberg claims to have been one of the only people in the world at this point to have read all 6 volumes of that. But if that sounds interesting to you, then you can then you could pick that up. I'm not going to focus on the inessential Carlyle. I'm going to give you a guide on how to get into his most important stuff. So with all of that said, his most important books are these ones. So that's the novel that I mentioned, Sartor Resterus. That's still taught on literature courses in some universities because it does an awful lot of interesting kind of meta and postmodern things, which I can tell you about in a second. The French Revolution, critical and miscellaneous essays on heroes, hero worship and the heroic in history, past and present, and the latter-day pamphlets. Those are his most essential works. And then he also has a lot of individual essays. In fact, most of what Carlyle wrote were little individual articles. And to be honest, that's probably the easiest way to get into Carlyle is to read his shorter pieces. Sign of the Times, or Signs of the Times, a very famous essay from 1829, on history is important. Chartism, his key argument against democracy. Dr. Francia, about the Paraguayan dictator, who he thought was really good, very controversial. Mencius Moldberg, incidentally, mentions that you should read that first as your introduction to Carlyle, the Dr. Francia essay. The occasional discourse on the Negro question. Sometimes you'll see that under an alternative title. And then there is Shooting Niagara and After. And those last two there are both reactionary masterpieces that I would consider to be essential Carlyle. So if you have a limited budget and you just want one Carlyle book, a one-stop shop, I would pick up this. It's from Animus Publishing, and it came out last year. It's called Thomas Carlyle Essential Political Writings. Costs, it'll set you back £18, which is not really that much in the overall scheme of things. You get a lot of bang for your buck here. You get Signs of the Times, Chartism, On Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History, Past and Present, The Occasional Discourse, Latter-day Pamphlets, and Shooting Niagara and After. And if you're wanting to pick up Carlyle for reactionary reasons, political reasons chiefly, rather than for his history or for his literary qualities, all of those ones are the essential ones to read. You could pick up that book and just read that one book, and that would be, you know, most of the essential Carlyle right there. The only problem with the essential political writings is that it doesn't have any real scholarly apparatus around. There's no introduction, there's no footnotes, there's no index. So if you want any of those extras, then stay tuned and I will tell you which copies to pick up. But if you're just looking for an easy one volume Carlyle companion and those other things aren't important to you, this is the one to get. Okay, and just to show you how complete this Essential Political Writings is, it's got basically three of his six most important books in there, and it's got of his most important essays four of the six that I've picked out there. So it's pretty complete in terms of what you're getting. So now I'm going to go through each of the books and tell you a definitive version and then a cheaper alternative. So if you are a real bibliophile and you've got a collector, or you want those scholarly extras that I'm talking about, the notes, the explanatory notes, the introduction, all of these sorts of details, then the best version of this novel, Sartor Resterus, is this one here. Came out from the University of California Press in 2000, and that is the one to pick up. It's from the Norman and Charlotte Strauss edition of the writings of Carlyle. Now, I have to admit, I have not actually read this book because I own it, but I haven't read it yet because it's very long, and I've had a long running policy of not reading novels. However, even though this is ostensibly a novel, it's not really. It's kind of semi-autobiographical by all accounts. And it tells the tale of this German idealist, kind of metaphysical philosopher and poet. And it's told through this device of an editor trying to piece together the bits of his life. So it sounds quite interesting. And from the bits that I've seen of it, there are all sorts of fantastic bits of wisdom and so on in there. So I may read this next. It may be the first novel I've read since 2003. And if I'm going to break my rule for anyone, I'm going to do it for Carlyle. Now, if you don't fancy spending 60 quid on this, then you can get a much cheaper copy for £3.59 from Oxford World Classics. And if you don't, if you don't have a fancy bookshelf and you don't care about, you just want to read it, you don't care about it lasting or anything like that, then this copy will be fine. The next one, and again, I have only started reading The French Revolution because it's absolutely massive. But from what I've read of it so far, he really does bring alive the people, the characters, the faces. It's like a kind of living, breathing, visceral history. And Carlyle is always Carlyle. He's, you know, idiosyncratic. He's moody. He's rhetorical. You know, he's always kind of berating. He casts judgment on everything. So he really is somebody who is bringing the French Revolution. This is not like a dry history. It's a partial history designed to try to teach you lessons in the present by learning from the past. It's a kind of didactic history, I guess you'd call it, but it's very interesting, especially if you're used to reading modern historians who are much drier, I guess. Carlyle belongs to an older 18th century tradition of popular history, I guess. But yes, his account of the French Revolution, I mean, I've only read the first part of the first volume, but I thought it was quite captivating. And this is the edition I've got, the 2001 Folio Society edition. Lovely it is as well. But if you don't fancy forking out the money, then there is the Oxford World Classics edition in one volume. And it's the 2019 version there, edited by David R. Sorensen and Mark Engel. So that's the one to pick up if you just want a copy of The French Revolution and you don't care about it being a prestige edition. Next, the very important book on heroes, hero worship and the heroic in history. This is where Carlyle outlines his theory of the great man, famous theory, of course, and along the way espouses all sorts of interesting thoughts and philosophizes basically about the nature of the world, the universe, and how these various heroes tap into what he calls the divine or the universal. And he looks at all sorts of people. He looks at Luther, he looks at Napoleon, Shakespeare, Dante, he looks at Muhammad at one point, Odin even. It's it really is a kind of unlike any other book you'll ever read. And again, if you want one with explanatory notes, if you want one with an introduction that's been put together by dedicated scholars, this version from 1993, put out from the Norman and Charlotte Strauss edition of the writings, University of California Press, this is the one to get. But of course, you can see, you could shop around a bit, but it's going to set you back a few quid if you get that one. Very nice editions they are, though, only in hardback. If you don't really need to go all out, a cheaper edition is this one. In fact, this is the version of the book I've got, which is, it's still, 16 quid, quite expensive for a paperback, I guess. But this one doesn't just have an introduction and scholarly notes, which are very helpful when you're reading Carlyle, because Carlyle's always referencing things and he's got tons of in-jokes and phrases that he loves to coin. And, he always refers back to his older works and things like that. Obviously, these guys are going to pick up on all those references and they'll be in the notes. But on top of that, it's got a bunch of essays on heroes, hero worship, and the heroic, by a group of Carlyle scholars, who put this together. Now, from what I've seen, there is a little bit of modern nonsense in there, but not as much as you might expect from Yale University Press in 2013. So, it's pretty good, this edition. So, if you can't afford the other one, I'm perfectly happy with this one here. Next, this is probably the most difficult bunch of books to get, the critical and miscellaneous essays. This has not had a modern scholarly edition, unlike all the other books that we've looked at. The closest you can get to is this 2010 facsimile, basically, put out by the Cambridge University Press, Cambridge Library Collection. They basically just reissued this book under a new slapped a new cover on it, you'd have to buy all five volumes separately, and they're 35, 36 quid each, so that is going to set you back if you buy all five copies. Now, unfortunately, there are certain essays that are only available in the critical and miscellaneous essays. That Dr. Francia essay I mentioned, for example, I haven't come across that reprinted anywhere else. I think it's in volume 3. You'd have to double check, but yeah, you'd have to that would cost you a lot of money to buy all five of those. Now, I have got basically an original copy from an 1899 issue of the book from Chapman and Hall. You can see here that they're really old, a bit tattered, one of them's faded in the sun. But I managed to find all five books, the collection for all five volumes, on Abe Books, which is a kind of secondhand bookshop website. I only paid £35 for all five volumes. So if you shop around, you may be able to find critical and miscellaneous essays, because they sold an awful lot of copies. One of the things about Carlyle, even though he may have fallen out of fashion a bit these days, in the 19th century, he sold thousands and thousands of books. I saw stats that, like, in one year, he made £977 in 1872, and sold something like 15,000 copies of, on heroes. And this collection here, Critical and Miscellaneous Essays, I mean, if you have a look at the reprint history, it was constantly being reprinted in the 19th century, and every run did like 15,000, 20,000, 10,000 every year. So because there are quite a few copies floating around, you may be able to pick up a bargain if you're willing to put the work in. I couldn't find any, when I was looking just for this video, but, have a look. I'm sure they come onto the market fairly frequently. It's not like Carlyle is that obscure. Then another alternative is, again, part of this Norman and Charlotte Strauss edition that the University of California did. There's a bunch of essays in this book, historical essays. They've basically just taken a bunch of his shorter essays, including the early Kings of Norway, which was a late Carlyle book. kind of interesting. I haven't read all of that yet, but that's a handy place to get hold of them. Now, that price there of £83 looks quite hefty. I paid significantly less than that. I think I paid about £40 for my copy of this. And even though there's a few essays in there which I have elsewhere, in fact, basically all of them are in the critical and miscellaneous essays, I actually just find it easy. I because those books are so old, I prefer to have options to like read a modern copy, so I don't worry about kind of harming the pages and things like that. And there's a very good essay at the start of this on Carlyle as a historian and how he thought about history, his cyclical vision of history, and how that fits into the Enlightenment view versus the German idealist view that was coming into fruition. And Carlyle actually was a, I guess you'd say, a third positionist between those two ways. Kind of reverted to the cyclical view of history. And then, speaking of history, past and present, another very good, seminal Carlyle work. He contrasts. So basically, what he does in past and present is he has one chapter looking, he has sections where he's looking at his contemporary Victorian London and being like, this country's going to the dogs. This place is going to hell in a handbasket. Where the age of mechanization and industry is ruining everything, basically. So you've got a lot of like the grumpy curmudgeon Carlyle, revolting against the modern world in the present section. And then in the past section, he kind of, he looks at around a few like medieval monasteries, and there's a chapter on the ancient monk, and he's going around like feudal society and outlining why he thinks that was a better way of life than the industrial way of life. So it's kind of an interesting exercise, especially for those of us who are trying to think of alternative structures for society that may look better than what we have now. And Carlyle comes as close as he does anywhere to presenting a positive vision for what he considers a better way of life in the 12th century compared to his contemporary life in the 19th century. Kind of a fascinating document. Now, if that £70 price tag puts you off, there's a much cheaper edition for just £8, which has the benefit of being having Chartism included in it. However, as with the earlier book I mentioned, there's no like, bells and whistles on that one. There's no introduction. There's no notes. There's no index. It's just a facsimile of the 15 on the of the 18 58 edition from Chapman and Hall. So, it's just kind of bare bones facsimile reprint. But, as far as they go, not a terrible one, and at least you're getting two for one in there. Although, frankly, if you're going to go down that route, you might as well get that essential one that I mentioned at the start because it has both of these in there. Next, there is the Latter Day Pamphlets, reactionary classic, probably the place to start with Carlyle if I was you. He's got The Present Time, which is a very famous essay lamenting what's become of Victorian England. Model Prisons is in there, where probably one of my favorite Carlyle pieces, where he's going around all these Victorian prisons and moaning basically about how they're not harsh enough. Anyway, the absolute state of the art edition of this came out in 1984, only in paperback, and it's this one. It's called Carlyle's Latter Day Pamphlets, edited by M.K. Goldberg and J.P. Siegel. Now, this edition is very hard to get hold of. I can't remember exactly how much I paid for it, but it was a pretty penny. But it is very good. It's got very detailed notes. It's, I mean, if you're a scholar of Carlyle, you want this. This is the definitive edition, without doubt, of the Latter-day pamphlets. Let me just check how much I paid for that before I move on from this. But the benefit of that is that it also has the occasional discourse in there. Does it include Shooting Niagara? Maybe it doesn't include Shooting Niagara. And it's got the occasional discourse in there, which is not usually included. In fact, I didn't pay that much. I only paid £12.80 for it. So if you root around long enough, one of those could come on the market for reasonably cheap. Clearly, there's none available at the moment. But have a look. Have a look at Abe Books. Make sure you put all those details in there, and you may come across it. Obviously, I picked up a bargain there. I remember it took me a long time to find that, though. I was hunting for that for 3-4 months. I had my eye on that, and when one came along, and I snapped it up. Now, if you're looking for Latter-day pamphlets, this is one of those that is not very well served by the tragedy of commons that we see on Amazon. Most of the editions that you'll find on Amazon only have the first 5 essays in there, and they finish at stump orator. There should be 8 essays in there, including Parliaments, Hudson's Statue, and Jesuitism, which is where Carlyle has a problem with the Jesuits. Like I said, the definitive edition includes the occasional discourse as well. Ideally, it's handy to have all 8 of those in the same place. So if you are going to pick up Latter-day pamphlets, you want all 8 of them. And if you can find the definitive one, it's probably worth the time and effort to hunt down. Because it really, in fact, of all of the scholarly editions I've got, that Latter-day pamphlet is very, very good work. And of course, in 1984, quite far away from modern nonsense. Now, if you're looking for, if you can't find that definitive one, there is this, I've called it cheap edition, it's not that cheap at £27, but there is the version from that library, Cambridge Library collection, reprint series. It's volume 20 of that. The way to find those is to type in, works of Thomas Carlyle, and then put the editor's name, Henry Duff Trial, in there, and it will bring that up. Now, again, there's no bells or whistles on that, but it's a clean, modern reprint, basically, of, the old 19th century copies. There is another version on there by Hansa Press, which is around the same sort of price, but again, it has nothing. And if you're going to fork out for a modern reprint, you might as well get the official Cambridge one. And then finally, the last book that I've got that I'll recommend is the Carlyle Encyclopedia. Now, that's currently going for over £96 at the moment. And there aren't that many copies of that floating around from what I've seen. I'll just tell you how much I paid for mine. Let's have a look. I paid £62.44 for mine. But it is a very, very good encyclopedia. It's like an A to Z encyclopedia. Everything you could possibly want to know about Carlyle is in that encyclopedia. And I've had many a fun hour flicking through that and looking at various different things in there. And in general, there's different ways you could play this if you want to get individual copies. One of the things that you could do is you could get the essential single copy for like £17, and you could hunt down a copy of this, and then you'd basically have all of the essential Carlyle. And instead of footnotes or instead of introductions or scholarly notes, you'd have all the information you need in this encyclopedia instead. I mean, it's a big, it's a big, thick book, and high quality as well, if you can find it. Now, there are tons of other books on Carlyle, but I just wanted this to be an introduction. I'll probably do another video on Carlyle down the road to go into some of his ideas and things like that a bit more. But people asked me to make this, so I thought I would oblige. See you again. Friends. Romans. Countrymen. Shh. Come this way. Lend me your ears. Secrets of ancient rhetoric can now be yours for a trifling sum. The art of persuasive argument is all around us. In fact, we are surrounded by it. We live in a rhetorical age, but this is seldom taught and even more seldom explained. It is not for you to know, they said. The master of grammar knows how to write with clarity, precision, and correctness. The master of logic knows how to disarm his opponents with reason alone, and both can be powerful adversaries. But the master of rhetoric can outflank both, caring as he does little for their rules and even less for their defeated tears. The master of grammar asks, "Is this sentence correct? Is this sentence clear?" The master of rhetoric wonders, "Does my speech have the power to sway the passions? Can my words move the crowd?" Yes, it can. Yes, it can. The master of logic trains his mind to eliminate fallacies and formulate correct and well-defined arguments. The master of rhetoric knows that the reasoning mind can be flooded with emotions, that the flood can short-circuit logic and overwhelm his opponent, who will crumple. They will wonder why their well-written, well-reasoned arguments were so defenseless against the rhetor's apparent ability to bend reality to his will. Do the faces in the crowd not see through this dark magic? The master of rhetoric laughed at their wonder. He looked at the bemused, despairing face of the master of logic and spoke. "Harness that wonder, my friend. It was your own beloved Socrates who said, 'The only true wisdom is in knowing that you know nothing.' And wonder is the beginning of wisdom." He turned to the master of grammar. "So lucid and correct your prose, but why does nobody listen to you? It was your own favourite, George Orwell, who wrote, 'Perhaps a lunatic was simply a majority of one.' Do not rail at the crowd for what is in their nature. Understand what they are, and they will listen to you." And with that, the master of rhetoric was gone. Find out what else he has to say by signing up to Foundations of Rhetoric. Fulfill your destiny and complete the trivium. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.